RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Kim Staton is a filmmaker, poet and musician from Northern Rivers, New South Wales, Australia. He is the writer and director of The Trustfall, Julian Assange. I think that's been screened here in New Zealand. And founder and director of Films for Change. He won an award for Best Emerging Director Australia at the Melbourne Documentary Festival last year. His movie, The Trustfall, which you can find out about at www.thetrustfall.org, has won various awards and continues to be shown in festivals all around the world. And I think it's fair to say that we all had a sense that last week was kind of a one for us when it came to truth and freedom. You know, the second phase of the COVID inquiry being announced and clearly the sort of range of terms of reference enunciated. And there was the release, and it is a release. Yeah, it's a release of Julian Assange back in Australia now after basically 12 years incarceration in the Ecuadorian embassy, Belmarsh prison, and facing a jail sentence like 170 years for using classified material, disseminating classified material through WikiLeaks. We first spoke to Kim about his movie, The Trustfall of Julian Assange, back in March, but we thought we'd catch up with him again to get his thoughts on Julian Assange's release, kind of what went into it, the constrictions that he's had to sign up to. Of course, he pleaded guilty. So a good time to get back in touch with Kim Staton, filmmaker. Kim Staton, it's good to have you back. Thanks for coming back on RCR.
Good to see you, Paul.
How are you feeling?
Yeah, well, it's been an incredible week, and I'm still really processing these amazing events of the week, and also a busy week of travel, traveling down to Canberra, and yeah, just still digesting this incredible news.
What sort of inkling did you have that this was about to happen, or was on the way, however you want to describe it?
Look, it's been something that's been put up in the air for around a year now, even longer, that perhaps there was a possibility of a plea bargain. I think in my mind it seemed unlikely because I thought Assange isn't somebody that compromises his principles. He didn't, when he was in the embassy, Ecuadorian embassy in London, he didn't agree to tell Trump who was the source of the DNC leaks, for example. You know, there's a quote of him saying that my principles are not for sale, end quote. Look, on Tuesday morning when my phone started going crazy with the news, I was really happy, of course, and I perfectly understand under the circumstances where his health is continuing to depreciate and with the looming extradition on the cards as a potential outcome where things would get worse for him, and considering the amount of time that he's been in the embassy and then the prison, 12 years of torturous conditions, you can't blame him at all for taking up that option if it was put on the table.
No, fair enough. I was wondering what sort of condition he would be in, and I was looking forward to seeing the footage of him, you know, arriving, and I saw him walking down the steps of that jet, and he struck me as looking pretty good, actually. He seemed to have good energy, I mean, from what you can tell, but he wasn't kind of like earlier pictures I've seen of him, sort of almost disheveled and sort of hunched over. He walked down those steps, and he was on his way. Is that the impression that you got?
Well, it was astonishing to see images of Julian for the first time in 5 years. The last time we saw anything of him was when he was going back and forth from the extradition hearing, a few photos inside the van, and then there was some leak footage from when he first arrived in Belmarsh, and he'd cut his hair quite soon after arriving to the prison because he doesn't want to look disheveled as they set up for him in, you know, when they carried him out of the embassy. So 5 years went by with not a single image, even when he was being married at Belmarsh prison in a couple of years ago. It was There was no photos allowed to be provided to the press, so they've done that to sort of make him invisible, to hope that he would fade away from the public eye. So to see those images come up, and it was actually WikiLeaks that put out the first video on Tuesday morning of him looking at documents, walking into the plane. He's put on some weight, which is great to see, because he did get very thin when he first went into the into Belmarsh prison, and he looks energetic. He looks quite well considering the ordeal that he's been through, and it was also evident that he was walking onto that private jet, not in handcuffs, not in custody, but as a free man.
Yeah. Seth Rich, right? Just getting back to who leaked the DNC docs. It was probably him. We could probably say that now, can't we? I know we don't know for sure, but it was probably Seth Rich.
Yeah, I don't know if that's ever going to be proven. And I think the focus should be on what's in those documents rather than calling out another whistleblower.
I want to get into documents or link material that's kind of been erased from WikiLeaks in just a moment. But first up, I want to read this quote from the promo to your movie. "This is a story of deception, lies, bravery, and a man who risked everything to bring the truth to light." I think that's Roger Waters saying that. And that's exactly what he did, right? Why did they want to, depending on who you listen to, they kind of wanted him dead. What was in what he knew, do you think, that took it to that level? Or is that always just the response of a state in a situation like this, if it ever came up before? Because they really wanted to smash him to pieces, and it just seems so next level without some explanation, you know?
Yeah, well, even in the Western world a couple of hundred years ago, if you just wrote something subversive, you'd be hung, drawn, and quartered, and your body dragged down the street. Like they did to William Anderton in London, an underground publisher, around 300-400 years ago. With Assange, what he and WikiLeaks did was to take on the mainstream narrative for the first time. So it was a combination of that, and then in 2010, 2011, when they started putting out these astounding documents, the Iraq war logs, which included the collateral murder video, 12 people being shot down from an Apache helicopter, including two Reuters journalists, and then the people that, the civilians that turned up to help, including kids in the van being shot at, the father being killed, and so on, and then the DNC emails, Cablegate as it is called, the Afghan war logs, Vault 7, which exposed the CIA hacking tools in our smartphones, computers, and even in our cars. All of this stuff in 2010, 2011 just completely freaked out this empire, the biggest empire that's ever existed, the most powerful empire on the planet. They don't like someone getting in the way, and the innovation of WikiLeaks just scared the pants off them, and they wanted to clamp down on him. Even well before that, around 2008, they were asking for advice from a firm called Stratfor on how to knock out WikiLeaks to undermine the public trust and just get them out of the picture. So it was a long-running strategy, and when he was in the embassy, the CIA under Mike Pompeo and with the US government under Trump were, doing up sketches of how to poison him, how to assassinate him in a street battle. That's something they seriously considered, and that was revealed through a Yahoo article where they interviewed, I think, up to 30 former US officials. So that's, one step in, or something that they considered at the time, of how to deal with this threat of WikiLeaks. And I think in the end they settled for lawfare, where they would chase him from country to country. And they did end up doing dozens of court cases. The extradition trial was only one of them. And so that ended up, that Assange was holed up in, had to seek refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years. And then they eventually put him in Belmarsh, based on that he jumped bail, didn't appear at the local police station while on house arrest. And they used that as an excuse to put him in a maximum security prison for more than 5 years. And I think the hope there was that he would go crazy. He would lose his mind, because his mind is the most thing that they're most scared of, this genius who built this incredible Rebel Library of Alexandria, this anonymous Dropbox. He's innovative. At the time, it was an invention that hadn't been seen. And, you know, so it's a combination of what he had done and what he might do in the future. They just didn't want that challenge. And so it's quite extraordinary now that he is a free man and has the opportunity, if he chooses, to return to work. The plea deal that he's agreed to it's not a gag order. It doesn't stop him from continuing his work. It's got a few specifications, which we can briefly talk about. One is that he can't publish any classified information that he's currently holding from these previous leaks. But it doesn't stop him from releasing new information that is passed on to WikiLeaks. And he does... he doesn't have a gag order, so he's not restricted from continuing the missions of WikiLeaks if he chooses to do so.
What do you make of the timing of his release? Is there anything in the timing that kind of attracts any attention, do you think?
Yeah, there's a lot in the timing, because, I mean, it's a combination of what was happening in the extradition trial that he'd just won the opportunity to have an appeal against the extradition. The US, in the US, of course, we have the presidential campaign going on, Trump and Biden vying for re-election. And I think it was an embarrassment to Biden. It was a nuisance for him. The rising swell of public opinion was just growing day by day. So it's, even in America, it's become, whilst it's still a polarizing issue, those that support Assange has probably superseded those that are against him by now. So they didn't want Assange, you know, didn't want to extradite him and have him arrive into the US in handcuffs and be on trial, and it would have been such a high-profile trial. You're seeing at every court hearing that the press coverage is increasing every time that they have a hearing, and so the press interest continues to grow. There was also Washington Post did an article 3 days ago where they revealed that there was an email sent by a Justice Department trial attorney who was stationed in Europe, and that was back in April. And he was advising, and this is a quote from the email, quote, "The urgency here has now reached a critical point. The case will head to appeal and we will lose."
Wow.
So
okay. Yeah.
It could well have been that they realized that these grounds of appeal were valid. Everything was leading towards Assange potentially winning the appeal and being completely free and not having a charge under any of the 18 count indictments. And that would have been a disaster for the US, because I guess in the end they wanted to get him on something. And so, you know, this result of this sort of a compromise between Assange and the DOJ is basically, you know, Assange having to plead guilty to one count of the 18 counts. So it's sort of a 17-1 result. Unfortunately, that thing that he's had to plead guilty to is explained as a conspiracy to obtain and disseminate classified information. And so essentially it's criminalizing for the first time under the Espionage Act a journalist. It's a shocking precedent. It's not a good outcome in that way, but it's something that he can appeal against. He can try to be pardoned which would perhaps in the future at some point, potentially wipe the slate clean for other journalists and whistleblowers. And that's an important sort of next step in that battle for protecting press freedom. But it's still quite a good win in that it was one count of the 18 counts, and he didn't end up being taken to the US being tortured, and he didn't end up, with a longer sentence that could have been up to potentially 175-year prison sentence.
Yeah, well, think about that. I can understand the Democratic Party's attitude to it. I don't quite get where Trump was coming from. I thought he was a genius in these matters. But he failed there, didn't he? Epically.
Yeah. Trump had all the opportunity in the world to, it was under Trump that the indictment was released, that the grand jury happened. It was under Trump that Assange was put into Belmarsh. That's very significant. And it was under Trump that Mike Pompeo was drawing up sketches of how to assassinate Assange. Then Trump, as he was departing from that term, that initial presidential term, he, as is a traditional thing, they pardon various people. He didn't pardon Assange, and he pardoned rappers and gangsters.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would believe that he would have freed Assange or pardoned Assange. At the recent Libertarian Party convention, you had Vivek Ramaswamy and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. say some really strong positive things, that they would free Assange on day one type of thing. Trump didn't even bring it up. But it's always, maybe he was keeping it under wraps, and maybe Biden was worried that that Trump would pull out that card at some point, perhaps when he, if he got into a second term as president, that he might pardon Assange and then make Biden look like someone that doesn't support free speech.
Yeah, well, it's not hard to make Biden look like anything that's not normal. Actually, in fact, he does it so well for himself. We heard, well, I heard, but everybody heard in the statements being made by Julian Assange's legal representation when they arrived in Australia, thank yous to Albanese, to Kevin Rudd, as if they, kind of did some crucial thing here. But this has happened over a long period of time, and plenty of people have been asking about, where has Australia been in this? So is there involvement from them, and is it at a level where they need to be thanked like that, or is that also part of the arrangement? Because you've got an election before May next year, I take it.
Yeah, I think politicians are really good at media opportunities, photo opportunities, and especially prime ministers, always looking for something to bolster their position and win favour. Albanese is really struggling with inflation here in Australia at the moment, I think he made some small step in that he backed up his, the quote that he was said to have, made in prior to being a prime minister. He said in a backroom deal that enough is enough. I can't see the point of this going on. It should be brought to a close. And then 6 months later, he did back that up in Parliament, repeated the statement verbatim, and then proceeded to just repeat it as a mantra. He never really upgraded it. It never became a call for his immediate freedom. So I think there's a bit of opportunist kind of exposure grabbing here on his side. I don't think this is something that was that came about through Australian government diplomacy, because FOI documents never showed any really important or crucial correspondence between the Australian and the US governments. What it revealed was that the Australian government was quite happy for Assange to be extradited, put on trial, and only then, once he's convicted, of these bogus claims that he might serve his time back in Australia. That was the official Australian line. So for Albanese then to sort of claim credit in the press conference on that day when Julian was, you know, freed in the in those courts in the Mariana Islands, you know, it just seemed like an opportunity to sort of pat himself and his colleagues on the back. The other part of it is, in a democratic country, you know, the government should be protecting their citizens, especially somebody that's an award-winning journalist, perhaps the most awarded journalist of our times, that has revealed, you know, exposed crimes of the powerful, done an incredible service to humanity. He's done nothing wrong at all. And for it to go on for 14 years and then for Albanese to take must be around 2 years to sort of, you know, really start to take a side in it. It's just taken too long. And so I feel that Albanese has done what he feels the vast majority of Australian citizens want. I mean, recent surveys have shown that in Australia it's something like 80% of people support Julian's freedom. You know, so the Assange's plane flew into Canberra. I think the main, I think that was part of the arrangement, was that the next day that they would go and get a photo opportunity with Stella, you know, shaking hands, having a hug from Penny Wong, the foreign minister. And, you know, Albanese was quick to sort of take the credit for it. But this is something that's gone on 14 years. You've had Prime Minister, government after Australian government after government, either being completely lock in step with the US on the persecution of Assange, claiming that he's a criminal, threatening to cancel his passport. Albanese was just the one that happened to be in power at the time that the public opinion rose so much that it became politically advantageous for him to show some support, because he never made that. He just did this merry dance, you know, playing each side, where he never really stood up to the US. He used this quiet diplomacy and just sort of, I think he just quietly said to them, look, this is becoming a bit of an issue. You know, any chance we can resolve it? Is there something we can swing? Apparently, the Australian government hired this private jet for Assange to travel home in, and it cost something like $750,000 Australian dollars. The Australian government put up the funds, but then Assange campaign had to quickly fundraise to cover that cost through his supporters. So they didn't make the gesture of paying for the travel. Meanwhile, they're buying, you know, billions of dollars worth of submarines from the American government, while there's still people up in my region that are living in tents after, you know, the poor effort with flood recovery after the massive floods a couple of years ago. So, you know, it's there's real corruption here, and I think Albanese's just playing politics. And look, it is good to see that in some way the Australian government is listening to the people, or at least responding to it, and doing their job to some degree.
Couple of quick questions to finish off. The deleted WikiLeaks documents that are involved, presumably the DNC files, right?
There's no deletion required. It's only that they can't put out any new documents.
That they already have, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't stop them from putting out new leaks in the future. There's a rumor going around, a false rumor, which I think might have started from this terrible ex profile called Cat Turd. It's an appropriate term. And then it was, you know, copied by, backed up by Mario Naufal and Andy No. I don't even follow these people, but I was just tracking how this rumor came about. So they claimed on X that DNC files had been deleted. But if you go to WikiLeaks website, they're still there. So that's not the case at all. What these people don't seem to understand, which really worries me, if they think that they're somehow involved in sharing the news is that the WikiLeaks website goes down very frequently. It's like any website. It can be attacked as much as it's encrypted. Well, the encryption is more relating to the anonymous Dropbox. But the website was designed with the strategy that, yeah, there's going to be attacks and takedown attempts and hacking of that website to try to destroy it frequently. And what Assange did was make sure that there was multiple copies at all times of that those 10 million documents, multiple servers. And so anytime, and it is important for people to know about this library that is the WikiLeaks website, anytime that it goes down, within usually typically up 3 days or less, it's back up again. It's an indestructible library, and that's how it was meant for. And so those documents are there for anyone to read, and I really encourage people to dive in and look at what the corruption that was exposed in the Democratic Party.
And wasn't one of the reasons that he was such a bad man is that he endangered the lives of assets of the US? And I think there's been an admission there that no one was damaged, no one was put in the firing line. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, that was another fascinating development in this short hearing that happened at Saipan Mariana Islands, where it was Judge Magnolona, hard to pronounce. This is a quote from that hearing. She said, quote, "There's another significant fact. The government has indicated there is no personal victims here. That tells me the dissemination of this information did not result in any known physical injury," end quote. And this was terrific that they included, that this judge included that. She seems to have some compassion for Julian and perhaps even some support. She also wished him happy birthday. But, you know, it was in 2013 at the trial of Chelsea Manning, who, as Bradley Manning, leaked the Iraq war logs to WikiLeaks. Now, at that trial in Fort Meade, the Pentagon had to admit that no lives were put at risk. And so this is actually a confirmation of that. And yet, I've seen in the last couple of days, mainstream media, particularly Sky News, Rubbish News, Murdoch, owned news in Australia, you know, starting off a conversation by saying he put lives at risk. They're still continuing this complete rubbish. So that's just shocking to see. And I think it's really time that these sort of media, mainstream media hack journalists do some research and do some reading before they just start spouting this rubbish.
And the film, The Trust Fall, well, I don't want to say great timing because, I mean, what happened to him should never have happened. But I mentioned the movie at the start. How's it been going? Where's it showing?
It released in cinemas in December last year. It's been out in cinemas 6 months now. It's been shown in around 350 cinemas across Australia, New Zealand, right. UK. It's been the most watched Australian documentary of the year in cinemas. We've had something like, I think 40,000 people have come through the cinemas. So it's been incredibly well received, and we're releasing it in US cinemas on the 17th of July.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and the film is, as you know, it's fully in support of Julian. We give 1 minute to his opponents and 133 minutes to his supporters, because I've always believed this is a case of oppression. And if you stand on the side of, on the fence in a case of oppression, you're siding with the oppressors, with the abusers. So, you know, the film was designed to help Julian get free, to build the campaign. I think it played some small part in that, to build public pressure, especially in Australia, where we reached millions, 5 million plus people with the trailer through advertising, thanks to our donors and investors. So we really reached at least a quarter of the Australian population, either with the trailer or through the film. I think that would have really helped to bolster the campaign. And, you know, it's wonderful that that in some way contributed to this result of Julian getting his freedom as a man, as a father, as a truth teller, as a peace activist. The battle still goes on, though, because we need to inform the public we need to tell this story to as many people as possible to prevent something like this ever happening again.
All right. Nice to catch up with you again, Kim. Kim Staton, who is the writer and director of The Trust Fall, Julian Assange, founder and director of Films for Change. Must point out that you did win an award too, right? Best Emerging Director Australia Award. You've got that somewhere on a mantelpiece or a shelf somewhere, I take it.
Thanks very much, Paul. Great to talk to you. Thanks for covering this important issue. And let's hope this is a turning point for free speech and press freedom, and that we can, you know, get people like David McBride out of prison and get pardons for Assange and Snowden in the near future.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.